that. We didn't know. So we set about doing a paper on Canadian sea cucumber crime. It just came out in the recent issue of the Bêche de Mer Information Bulletin, the premier journal of all things sea cucumber. Incidentally, the only journal of all things sea cucumber. Yeah, and my co-authors and I took a dive into Canadian sea cucumber fisheries between 2015 and 2022.
Right. And in reading that article, there's a lot in there, but one of the big takeaways is that there's a lack of general interest or awareness or sort of coverage of whatever sea cucumber crime there might be, right?
Yeah, well, and this is a challenge we have with our work because basically, when people think of wildlife crime, and ever, listeners, think about wildlife crime. The first thing that came to your mind was likely elephants, tigers, lions, maybe rhinoceros, terrestrial charismatic species, and that's for a good reason because these are really important species, and there's been challenges around protecting them for years. If you're thinking of marine wildlife crime, people are likely going to jump to shark finning, as we've already discussed. Maybe whaling, maybe illegal fishing of very charismatic animals like bluefin tuna. But even that is a bit of a stretch. But one of the things that I found in my work is that wildlife crime comes in all shapes and sizes. You quite literally have people smuggling caterpillar fungus out of Mongolia. You have live, special spiders being smuggled out of Brazil. People collect baby cheetahs. Please don't, by the way. And so one of the challenges you get is that people are simply unaware of the breadth of wildlife crime. It is both a bad thing and a good thing. It's a bad thing insofar as there's less attention to it, so there's less political pressure to motivate governments to step up and take action. It's a good thing insofar as groups like ours who are working on the issue, the criminals aren't as smart. So it's a lot easier to infiltrate their networks. The Mexico cases notwithstanding, what we found is a lot of the criminals, less security conscious. And so as a result, it's a little bit easier to infiltrate and wind up networks, which incidentally are similar supply chains and networks that are used to smuggle people, guns, and drugs. But those folks tend to have higher security protocols. Whereas people who are just, traveling with a suitcase full of sea cucumbers or fish maw, they're a little less security conscious. But also, governments are less aware of these situations. So, for example, if someone goes through customs with 300 grams of dried fish maw in their suitcase, that could just be a gift for a friend. It's for my grandmother. Well, I found a chunk of fish maw in Singapore when we were doing an investigation there a few years ago for $96,000 Canadian for 300 grams of fish. So
Whoa.
suddenly you have a way of transporting large values of money across borders in ways that some customs and law enforcement may not be aware of. So yeah, it's one of those interesting, sticky issues. But if people take one thing away from our interview, it would be that crime is targeting a wide range of wildlife, animals across the world, and sea cucumbers is one of them.
All right, so what does sea cucumber crime in BC look like?
Yeah, so our paper looked at sea cucumber fisheries between 2015 and 2022. And what was interesting here was actually a lack of cases. So we only found a total of 24 cases. And to find these cases, by the way, we looked through media stories, legal decisions, and police records. Most of the cases were from police records, which to us indicated that those cases weren't sufficiently exciting enough to warrant media attention. What's interesting is we have a big case hitting right now in Nanaimo, and that case just fell outside of the window of our research, so we didn't actually capture that one. I think now there would be a lot more news stories because it's a hot button topic, and I'm sure we'll talk about it in a few minutes. But what we found was one news story, one legal case, and then 22 cases from the Department of Fisheries and Oceans. And most of those cases were administrative. Out here in British Columbia, we had 13 cases total over that time period, and most of them were just people who forgot their license on the day of. That's a $35 fine. You go show your license to DFO a couple days later, everything's kind of taken care of. There was a couple cases involving falsification of records, but the three criminal cases were ones that mostly revolved around people exceeding their daily catches, using prohibited gear, and fishing out of season, those kinds of things. But what was interesting was they weren't as violent or as highly organized as some of the cases we've seen in other countries, which is reassuring. But the problem, of course, is if we're not seeing a lot of cases, it's very hard to know if it's because there aren't a lot of cases or if criminals are simply getting away with it because it's falling off the radar of law enforcement. It's always very hard to tell.
I have a degree in archaeology, and the number one of the number one rules is the absence of evidence is not the evidence of absence, right?
Exactly. And this is one of the challenges with the approach we've taken. We don't have the budget to go into the field. Like, in an ideal world, I'd be out with my colleague Gary, who's a drone operator. We'd be looking for drying sites on the roofs of villages in communities where we know there's sea cucumber fishing. And we'd be trying to, you know, correlate that with fishing records and looking for poachers and illegal dry sites. We can't do that right now. So a lot of times you rely on the media stories, which of course becomes kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy. But our approach has allowed us to better understand the countries that are starting to step up, and also to understand some of the modus operandi of criminals. So in our work in Mexico, for example, we uncovered at least two cases where sea cucumbers were stored in wineries in their cellars between seasons, so that they fished over their limit 1 year, they could store the sea cucumbers and then reintroduce them into the market the next year using new paperwork. And that was an interesting revelation.
And I mean, obviously it's just speculation, but do you think that there is more crime in sea cucumber fisheries than is reported?
Absolutely. Yeah, no, we know this for sure. And like, so just for a bit more background for folks, in British Columbia, there's both a commercial and a recreational fishery for sea cucumbers. So there is a legal fishery. There's about 30 vessels. Their annual take is, I think, around 614 tons. It's open for 8 weeks of the year, starts in October, and it brings in around like $15 million in value to the BC economy. That's from a couple of years ago. And the recreational fishery, folks can have a 12 animal limit. There's a maximum number that you're allowed to take. And there's obviously as well as the First Nations fisheries as well. So basically, like with, for example, the recreational fishery, some of the cases that we found were examples of people fishing over their daily limit. So the recreational limit here in British Columbia is 12. And one of the cases from Sydney in 2015, the person had 527 sea cucumbers on them.
Whoa.
So a little bit higher than 12. My math isn't always that good, but certainly higher than 12. And those people received a $5,000 fine. So you can kind of read between the lines there that that punishment may or may not deter future criminal activity. But yeah, we know that there's a lot of criminal activity going on in fisheries because you have people operating in remote areas. I couldn't speculate on the size of it, but there's definitely people who are probably recreationally fishing over their limits. And for all we know, there's other poachers out there who have larger scale operations. And other countries, we've seen that. One example was in Alaska, where we reported this in our book chapter that had come out on sea cucumber crime. And there was a father and son that were bringing in way more sea cucumbers than anyone else was. And they were just chatting at the bar, and someone just looked at their records, and it looked like they went right into a protected area, fished the protected area, and came back out. And there were a lot of sea cucumbers there because it was a protected area, allowing the populations to recover. So in remote areas or areas where there's just huge coastlines, it's very challenging to do enforcement.
So as you're sort of referencing there, there are protections and there are rules and quotas and protected areas and all that, but these seem to be insufficient to give sort of full protection. Do you have any ideas or thoughts about what could be done to better protect these populations?
There's a range of things. Obviously, ongoing and continued enforcement and monitoring is critical. It's important that governments take these situations seriously. And I think one of the roles that I've had in the movement, the broader narrative and conversation around illegal fishing, has been trying to push governments to understand that illegal fishing is organized crime. So I've already given you some examples of organized crime syndicates involved in sea cucumber fishing. One more example would be the Yakuza in Japan. Allegedly in 2018 made more money on sea cucumber operations, illegal sea cucumber operations, than they did selling methamphetamines. Again, no one's had a chance to crack open the books of the Yakuza, so I don't know if that's necessarily true, but there were some interesting news stories on it. So one of the things that I've been trying to do is just to communicate to governments that illegal fishing isn't just an administrative crime. It's not just we're going to give you a small fine, go about your day. It's organized crime. And if you look at international definitions of organized crime, it's more than two people working over a protracted period of time, engaged in organized criminal activity. That's what illegal fishing operations are. And when governments look at them from that lens, suddenly they see people who are stealing from the government by not paying taxes and paying for permits. They're seeing people who are engaged in criminal activities that are linked to other criminal activities, and it ideally motivates them to take action. The other thing, too, is, of course, making sure the punishment fits the crime. So again, with these administrative crimes, they're so often seen as a fine. So the people who were found with 527 sea cucumbers and are fined $5,000, that may or may not be the value of that catch. Like that may be less than the value of that catch. And if they've been doing that for multiple days, it just becomes part of the cost of doing business. And we've seen this time and time again around the world where the punishments for wildlife crimes are not as serious as if you steal other things. If someone walks into a bank and steals $10,000, they're going to jail for a protracted period of time. If they steal $10,000 worth of fish, they might just pay a small fine. And that's, of course, a huge problem.
We have mentioned or referred to it earlier, and maybe in terms of consequences for sea cucumber crime or fishery crimes. We've talked about the case of Scott, or referred to the case of Scott Stanley Matthew Steer. What can you tell me about that and what it means for this process?
So right now, as we're speaking, at the beginning of May, Scott Steer, the most notorious sea cucumber poacher in Canadian history, is going through the sentencing at the courts in Nanaimo. So basically, this is the largest Canadian sea cucumber crime, to my knowledge, in Canadian history. I will couch that insofar as we only looked at cases going up to 2015. So historically, there could be other cases, but I think it's somewhat unlikely. Basically, Scott Steer was someone who was already prohibited from fishing because of previous poaching activity targeting Dungeness crabs, halibut, prawns, and other species. The man was prohibited from being on a fishing vessel until 2038. Yet in March 2020, some people saw a boat off the ferry that was operating without lights, and they reported it to the authorities. The authorities show up, DFO shows up, they give chase. Scott Steer's on board the vessel, throws his cell phone over the side of the boat. He's eventually arrested. 3 days later, DFO sends divers down to retrieve the cell phone. They find the phone and they use the information on it to charge him on at least 6 counts of illegal fishing involving sea cucumbers. But first of all, mad respect to the people in DFO for diving and finding a cell phone under the water. I know many people
That's
who've
crazy.
lost their phones off the docks might be thinking, well, maybe I can call my friends at DFO now. But I was, very impressed by that operation itself. But he was smuggling, the numbers I'd written down from looking through the court cases were around 87,000 pounds of sea cucumbers, which is close to $1 million Canadian in value, depending on where you price it out in the supply chain. So that was very eye-opening. And as we speak in Nanaimo, he's going through sentencing, and we should know by the end of the day on May 1st or May 2nd what the actual sentencing will be.
Do you know what the range of potential sentences is?
I don't know. So, as a non-lawyer, I couldn't speculate. But this is an interesting case because this isn't his first time, right? This is someone that Maclean's magazine described as the most prolific poacher on the West Coast, and is well known to law enforcement. And as I mentioned earlier, he's prohibited from, owning and setting foot on a fishing boat until 2038. So, my hope would be that the punishment fits the crime as well as the context. But I don't know what the exact sentencing should be.
It's interesting too, to sort of tying back to what you were saying about fisheries crime and fisheries criminal being sort of less sophisticated in their approach and in their systems. Just reading through the court case filings, he's just openly speaking about these things in Facebook Messenger messages, and there are bins in his garage labeled like sea cucumber and or the name of the business he's selling them to. And it just seems like there is an attitude that no one cares enough to catch me, sort of.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, his wife was a director of a company, and he was actively recruiting, people to work on the boats and do dives with him and collect sea cucumbers. This is something we see time and time again in the industry. Like, one of my favorite stories is I'm all over the online forums of people who sell sea cucumbers
Of
with my
course.
own Facebook profile because I'm too lazy to set up another one. And I'll have people reach out and try to sell me sea cucumbers, which to me is kind of baffling because, like, all you really need to do is Google my name. And my name is not one of those obscure, it's a name that's easily Googleable.
That's not John Smith.
Yeah, I had someone message me on WhatsApp using my phone number, like my personal phone number that's on my website, which indicates that I work on sea cucumber crime, and they offered to sell me sea cucumbers. And every time I asked them a question, we went back and forth. I was standing in line at a shop, so I'm like, yeah, why not? We'll have a conversation here. Every question I asked them, they were admitting to another crime. So, like, where are the sea cucumbers? India. Well, you can't fish for sea cucumbers in India. How do you get them out of the country? Oh, we ship them out of New Delhi. Well, that's illegal. How do you get them through customs? Oh, well, we report them as a gift and as dried fish products, so you don't pay taxes. Well, that's two crimes right there. How do I pay you? Bitcoin. So the whole thing, this whole interaction is basically someone just admitting to additional crimes. I, of course, send that along to my friends in law enforcement in India, and it's in their hands now. So, yeah, the level of sophistication isn't as much as you'd see in people doing other types of criminal enterprises, but at the same time, it can be quite sophisticated. One of the examples I can draw on is in India, you'll actually have sea cucumbers that are stored for protracted periods of time until they have like enough to do a shipment. They'll bale them up, put a tracking device on them, and drop them out in the ocean. And then another boat will come pick them up afterwards using that same beacon.
Wow.
So it's kind of like a James Bond operation. So there are some sophisticated operations in that way. And also false labeling and, you know, forged paperwork. Those always involve a lot of effort on the part of criminals.
And that is an indication of the value that is there to be had, right?
And for folks who are listening too, like we haven't talked about that much, but the most valuable sea cucumber right now that you can buy in the shops in Shangwan and Hong Kong is the japonicus, the little spiky Japanese sea cucumber. And they sell for around $3,500 per kilogram. That's a lot of money. Now, that's obviously the end product in the markets in Hong Kong. The fishers aren't getting that much for them. The ones we were looking at in Mexico were around a couple dollars per sea cucumber to the fisher, but they're selling for $300-$400 a kilo in Shangwan. So basically, there's money to be made in these. And I think a lot of times we underestimate the value of illicit wildlife products. In addition to sea cucumbers, one of the ones that fascinates me is caterpillar fungus. This is possibly an aside that may be off topic, but you know how there's some mushrooms that take over animals' brains and make them go crazy? People have seen The Last of Us now. I think it's become more popular. Before that show came out, I sounded like a bit of a crazy person presenting that. But there's, yeah, mushrooms that take over animals' brains, and there's a worm that lives in Mongolia. And the mushroom will take over its brain and it will go to the surface of the grass, and the mushroom pops out of the top of its head. People will crawl across fields to collect these mushrooms. They're only like the size of a pen, maybe half the size of a pen. And they sell for more than platinum. Like if you look up caterpillar fungus on Amazon, it's like $3,000, $4,000 per 100 grams. Like it's absolutely baffling how expensive and valuable these products are. And so you can think, you know, there's money to be made. So greed motivates things. And they're also a way of transporting value across borders. So money laundering's at play as well.
Seems to me like eating a fungus that is known for taking over the brain of another animal is not the greatest idea, but you know.
I'm certainly not going to eat them myself. But it is fascinating. Like when you go down to some of the markets in like Singapore and in Hong Kong, what you see for sale, whether it's Canadian seal penises or you know, chatoush shawls from endangered ungulate fur, sea cucumbers, shark fins, abalone, seahorses is one I see a lot of. You'll have a bottle of wine with seahorses floating in it, and they're almost certainly they don't have CITES papers for export import. So yeah, it is pretty wild, the sheer scale of wildlife crime and the different species that are targeted and the money that often changes hands.
So beyond sort of awareness of as you're saying, the scale of wildlife crime, what would you want listeners to take away from this conversation?
I think it's really challenging for a consumer to know where they're getting their food from, but that's very important. So one aspect would just be know what you're eating and where it comes from, if at all possible. But a lot of this, it's so difficult for the consumer to know, like a falsely labeled product or a product that was laundered through legitimate markets. You can't do the research yourself. So really, we need to have pressure on governments to take these things seriously. And that would be my biggest takeaway, would be we need to consider wildlife crime as a serious crime and as a serious form of organized crime. And that needs to motivate governments to assign the necessary resources to tackling this crime. You know, we have these conversations around, you know, drug smuggling and the impact that fentanyl has on our communities, and that's a huge issue. And I think a lot of times people are unaware of the fact that that same level of organized crime is being used to devastate ecosystems, whether they're marine or terrestrial. And governments need to be stepping up and taking them as seriously as they do other forms of organized crime.
Right, and regardless of where the money is coming from, what product is being transported or laundered, it's all money funding organized crime, right?
And not only that, it's even more like, yes, and sometimes it's not even money. One example I'd point out is with abalone in South Africa. There was a triangular trade situation with organized crime groups where they would trade abalone for methamphetamine precursors and they would trade those for firearms. And so no money was changing hands. It was like this barter economy. When we were looking at cases in Mexico, there was some weird cases that came up on our radar where a drug house would be raided and they'd find tons of drugs and then a couple of sea cucumbers and a shark fin. Why were those there? Well, people were exchanging wildlife products for drugs and avoiding the whole cash economy in the first place. So there's all these other layers to it as well. And it just really underscores the importance of considering wildlife crime and impacts on our environment as seriously as we do other forms of organized crime.
Great. Well, thanks, Teal, for joining me today. and sharing all of this with our listeners.
It was great talking to you. Yeah, and if folks are interested, the paper is not behind a paywall. It's on the Best American Information Bulletin, and it's Characterizing Canadian Sea Cucumber Fisheries. And I'm looking forward to our next paper. Our next deep dive is going to be into looking at another global review, looking for more hotspots. I suspect we're going to find some more cases in the South Pacific as some of the islands have opened up their fisheries there, but we'll see what happens. And yeah, the Oceans Asia Research Team is always looking for opportunities to help protect marine species.
Great. Thanks again. I'll link to the paper in the show notes here. I did read it. It's academic, but it was a pretty easy read and lots of interesting stuff in there. So thanks again for joining me.
Thanks for reading the paper.
Yeah. And one more time, thank you to Teal Phelps-Bondaroff for joining me for that conversation. I found it very interesting, and I hope you did too. And as I said just there, I will be posting the link to the paper at cgsf.ca with the rest, with the podcasted version of this episode. So you can check it out there. This is Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. And we have a little bit more time. I'm going to play some more local music. This is by Kara Bateman from her record Daddy Issues. And this is, I play this song on the Vancouver mixtape on Sunday. And I said it then, and I'll say it again. This is the only Joe Rogan content you will ever get on CJSF. And this is called Joe Rogan Broke Up My Relationship. Welcome back to Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. That's Kara Bateman with Joe Rogan Broke Up My Relationship. And we have just enough time for one more story here. It is playoff hockey playoff season, NHL playoff, and PWHL playoff season. And the Winnipeg Jets are currently in the middle of their second round series against the Dallas Stars. They play tonight. They have a chance to go up 3-1, while Dallas will be trying to even the series. But I have a story from Ryan Funk in Winnipeg about how a self-taught embroiderer is fueling the playoffs spirit out there in Manitoba and scoring business success. So, with thanks to the Local Journalism Initiative and Frequency News and Ryan Funk from CHEB-FM, here it is.
This community update was brought to you by U Radio. Downtown Winnipeg has been erupting with energy as Winnipeggers cheer on the Winnipeg Jets in the Stanley Cup playoffs. Crowds aren't the only thing getting energized, with local business, Dreamcatcher Promotions, working nonstop to keep up with demand. With the whir of machinery, 25,000 towels have been produced for Game 2 of the Winnipeg Jets versus the Dallas Stars. CEO Michelle Cameron says that's an addition to official apparel.
We are printing the towels for Game 2, which is 25,000 towels, and then we're also printing the apparel that goes into the store. So we print the t-shirts, the hoodies, the crew necks, the long sleeves, the kids, the women's, all of the apparel that goes into the stores, we print that here.
Production is currently running 16 to 18 hours a day to meet demand.
There's so much pride that goes into it, and I think we forget about our tiredness because it's just an opportunity that doesn't come every day. So this is like a dream come true for us to be able to print the Winnipeg Jets stuff. And, you know, it's a dream come true for me because that was one account that I thought I would always, it would always be a dream. I never thought it would come true. So it's happening today.
Dreamcatcher Promotions has been in operation for over a decade now, but not where Cameron first got her start. As early as 14 years old, Cameron has wanted to be an entrepreneur, dabbling in smaller business ventures over the years. When she first started her company, it was solely for embroidery to create team apparel, a $2.3 billion industry in Canada alone. She says she thought if she could even get a half of a percent into that industry, she would be golden.
I didn't know really what I was doing. I bought a used embroidery machine on Kijiji, and I watched YouTube videos how to embroider. So I self-taught through YouTube how to embroider logos onto garments. So once I felt, it was probably a few months before I felt confident enough to say, I owned an embroidery machine, so once I did that, I made business cards, called a Dreamcatcher embroidery at the time, handed them out everywhere I went, and built my business from there.
The company can now produce 8,000 prints a day, and to date, has produced 140,000 towels for the whiteout events. The contract with the Winnipeg Jets didn't happen overnight. It was the result of years of intentional relationship building and mutual trust.
We've had a relationship with the Winnipeg Jets for the last 2 years. Mark Chipman and I spoke at an event together, and it eventually led to coffee. And then so we talked about, so I'm big on relationship building, and so is Mark. So we had a relationship before doing work for the Jets, and there had to be a trust on both sides, right?
However, this boon in business from her relationship with the Jets isn't just about her. As an Indigenous-owned and operated company, Cameron says the success of Dreamcatcher Promotions is a beacon for other Indigenous entrepreneurs that opportunities are growing.
I've seen it. I'm the chair of the Indigenous Chamber of Commerce, so we're seeing a growth in Indigenous businesses, something we've never seen before, and it's really great to be part of that. And I think there's a lot of opportunities for more Indigenous businesses. So when we got this contract, it was more than just us, more than just a win for our company, but a win for the Indigenous community as a whole, because now it opens up the mind and it opens up hope for people to see, well, because she did it, then I can do it. You know what I mean? So it's restoring hope.
The 2016 Indigenous Contributions to the Manitoba Economy Report reveals that Indigenous communities contributed $9.3 billion to Manitoba's economy in 2016. With the Jets heading into Game 2 today, Cameron says they are already looking ahead, utilizing their recent exposure to grow new partnerships, despite the uncertainties caused by the on and off again threat of tariffs.
The tariff thing is frightening for some, but it's actually making us look at in our home, right? Look right here in Manitoba. Who can we support? How can we support local? How can we support Canadian companies? And that's what we do as a company. Like, this is a win for us, but also a win for the other companies within Winnipeg and within Canada, because now we have sourced all of our Canadian suppliers that we can to make this happen.
Cameron says they are cheering on the Jets and hope they can make it to the finals, taking home the Stanley Cup. Even if the Jets come short, she says the excitement has re-energized local businesses and the potential for new Indigenous entrepreneurs to come out with their unique ideas. With U Multicultural and the Local Journalism Initiative, I'm Ryan Funk.
CJSF is looking for new volunteers to come in and make radio. No experience is necessary. You can learn to DJ, edit sound, produce news, make posters, and host your own show. Come out to a weekly station orientation to get involved. Orientation times can be found on our website at www.cjsf.ca.